Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Sarah Fenske. Yogi Berra is one of Major League Baseball's all-time greats, a catcher who hit 385 home runs, a three-time MVP award winner, and a 15-time All-Star. He was also a beloved personality who made good money as a pitchman for everything from Yoo-Hoo to Puss in Boots cat food. But in 1941, Berra was just Lorenzo Berra, better known as Lottie, a 16-year-old St. Louis kid who just loved baseball. His Italian immigrant father wanted him to grow up, get a real job. Pietro Berra had already convinced two of his older sons to quit promising baseball careers for work at a bakery and a shoe factory, respectively. The Berra parents brought in the priest at St. Ambrose to mediate with their obstinate fourth son. The priest agreed he should probably give up baseball. He didn't, and the story of why and what happened next is the focus of John Pessa's new book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask, and the author is here today to talk to us about it. John Pessa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. How are you today?
So you set the scene so perfectly back in 1941 when Lottie Berra's father didn't want him to play ball. But it wasn't just his father who thought he had little potential in baseball. It was also the Cardinals' general manager, the great Branch Rickey. How did this kid come up short in Rickey's estimation?
You know, this story was told to me by Red Shandings, who was the Hall of Fame infielder for the Cardinals and the Pirates. And he was at a tryout. There were a couple of thousand kids. They got it down to eight kids. He couldn't remember the other five, but the three were himself, Joe Garagiola, and Yogi Berra. And it came to Red to pitch to Yogi, and he said he couldn't get a pitch by him, and the sound of the bat hitting the ball was harder than anything that he'd ever heard before or since. And he thought he was a cinch to be signed. But Branch Rickey looked at, he was acknowledged as the best talent judge in baseball. And one of the things that he was supposed to be able to do was to look at a 16-year-old kid and project what he would look like as an adult. And baseball is pretty hard to pick teenagers who are going to project into being great baseball players. And Yogi Berra was a terrific athlete put together with what looked like spare parts. good spare parts, but stubby leg, the torso of someone who was 6'2", long arms, thick shoulders that hit his neck, and Rickey just didn't think that he looked like a baseball player. And he literally told him, he said, "Son, I'm telling you this for your own good. I don't think you're anything better than a Triple A baseball player, and we're looking for kids that can go all the way."
What a mistake!
And he didn't make many, but that was a big one.
So it wasn't just Branch Rickey who didn't see the potential here. His Italian immigrant family, they were down on this. You had a great quote from the priest at St. Ambrose, who I hope this quote is actually 100% accurate because it's just too good. "What you are doing is beyond all reason. No wonder your good mother and father are afraid you're going to turn into a bad boy." Baseball, I guess at that point, was not considered a path to greatness.
Not to Italian immigrants on the Hill. Both Yogi's father and Joe Garagiola's father came from the old country and didn't understand baseball, didn't understand the grip that baseball had on their sons. And Yogi had three older brothers that were all good ball players. And Yogi, to his dying day, said that his oldest brother, Tony, was the best player. And I was lucky enough to meet three men on the Hill who were Yogi's contemporaries. Two of them lived on Elizabeth Avenue with Joe and Yogi, of course, then called Lottie. And the fathers couldn't understand baseball and thought games were for kids, and you're a man, you go to work. And as you said, the oldest brother in a bakery, the middle brother spent his time working on shoes and the women's shoe factory, and the third brother was a waiter at Ruggiero's until later on came east with Yogi to run the Phil Rizzuto Yogi Berra Bowling Alley. And so it took a lot of convincing And Yogi was, you know, when others didn't see the path to success, Yogi insisted he was going to be a great, you know, a good baseball player, and he turned out to be a great baseball player.
So one of the things about this book, you tell that story so well, and it's also just such an enjoyable book for people who are interested in St. Louis history, because you really get into the culture of the Hill, what it was like in those days, and you get the sense that just being a part of that group of kids on Elizabeth Avenue, this must have shaped him into the ballplayer that he was, that he and Joe Garagiola just got better and better because they had each other as competitors. Do you think he would have been who he was if he hadn't had this really talented baseball player just right across the street?
I'll tell you, I mean, him and, you know, Joe used to say that there wasn't a day that that he didn't know and be best friends with Yogi Berra, which was true until their dying days. And that certainly pushed both of them, but they loved, even though they grew up in the during the Depression, it was, you know, a neighborhood full of kids. They were always playing baseball or football or soccer, and they loved their life. I mean, when I talked to, as I said, the three men, Charlie River, Quinn Garavaglia, and Vince Deramundo. I'm sorry if I pronounced all of those well.
Those are some great Italian names right there.
Yes, and they just said, you know, their fathers all worked in the mines and the clay factories in St. Louis. They were working poor. They never went without, but they never had more, any more than they needed. In fact, one of the great stories that I was told was about the boys following after the truck that went from the market to the dump, where it dumped all the rotted fruit and vegetables. And they would get their penknives out, and they would carve out parts that were still ripe, and that would be their jewel for the week. So it was a very different life, but they all grew up, they said they all grew up happy. They played ball all the time, and I think that's what really instilled not just the athletic talents, but the kind of values that Yogi had all his life, I think, you know, came from that camaraderie and that feeling that nobody was better than anybody else and we're all in this together type of feeling that there was on the Hill.
So when you talk to people who knew him on the Hill, they all knew him as Lottie. When did he become the famous Yogi?
Well, actually, this is part two of the Brent Rickey story. So he leaves. Joe Garagiola leaves and goes to Springfield to play ball, and Yogi plays American Legion baseball, which is the best amateur baseball in the country. And in fact, the Depression had kind of wiped out high school baseball because kids went off to work. And a kid named Bobby Hoffman from St. Louis, who ends up becoming a utility infielder for the New York Giants later on, a whole group of them go to see a movie. And in those days, movies also came with newsreels. And there was a newsreel on India, and they saw a bunch of yogis sitting the same way that Lottie Berra sat before he went up to bat, with his legs crossed and his arms crossed across his chest. And Hoffman just turns to him and says, "I'm going to call you Yogi from now on." And for whatever reason, it stuck. And what a blessing for someone who made a lot of money as an advertising person. Everyone knows who Yogi is. If you said Larry Berra, I'm not so sure that it would have been quite as catchy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great name. It's one of those unforgettable things. You hear it once, and you can immediately sort of bring to mind the man.
Absolutely.
But when it comes to his appearance, you know, Branch Rickey kind of wrote him off as didn't really look like a ball player. One of the big revelations in this book for me, who didn't live in this era, the fans and even other players were positively vicious about his appearance. You had some shocking examples of this. Tell us what some of these things they were saying, if you can repeat them on the radio.
Sure. It was pretty stunning to me. Number one, I didn't understand how much discrimination Italian Americans felt in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s and beyond. But they also, people made fun of Yogi's appearance about calling him, once he made it to the major leagues, he was the captain of the all-ugly team. Players would hang from the opposing players would hang from the dugout with one hand and scratch under the other arm, making like a monkey. his own manager called him the ape, not as a as an insult, but I think that almost made it worse for Yogi, that these were his friends and they were also using these kind of terms. And the one that really struck me was Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times columnist Arthur Daly wrote a column, many columns on Yogi, but on one particular column in the early going, the headline on it was Nature Boy. Mm. So he was called Nature Boy, Ape, Quasimodo. And what really amazed me was that somebody who endured that much abuse and that lasted, you know, the questioning of his looks and the questioning of how smart he was, that lasted all the way through his managing career into the 80s, 1980s. And you would think that that kind of experience would turn you into a bitter person, and there was no less of a bitter person than Yogi Berra. I mean, he was just happy and open and welcoming.
You also tackle this idea, you know, he kind of had this twisted relationship with the English language. A lot of people thought he was dumb. Was he dumb?
Well, I'll give you two reasons to say absolutely not. One, the man made a lot of money as a businessman. He gave stock advice to other players on the Yankees. He knew his worth, and he got every penny from it. You can't do that and be dumb. But one of the things that really struck me, I mean, the catcher is the most complicated position on a baseball field. And the catcher has to know what every single player is going to do when the ball is hit, no matter where it's hit. But he also has to handle the most high-strung people on the team called pitchers. And to be able to get great results day in and day out, because Yogi caught almost every game, which was amazing. To be able to reach these players and to psychoanalyze them and to get them in the proper frame of mind. And trust me, I played catcher. It's not an easy thing to do, and he did it exceptionally well. So no, I don't think Yogi was by any stretch a dumb man.
And you mentioned that this really bothered his wife, Carmen. She didn't like that people didn't always take him seriously. And she, you know, their love story is just this great part of this book. Tell us about how they first met. As a St. Louisan, I loved this story.
Yeah, I'll tell you. It's so Yogi is a rookie in 1947, and he's an instant star, and the Yankees win the World Series. And he comes back home, and now he's still hanging out with his friends from the Hill, but he's also playing golf with Stan Musial and with Biggie's from Biggie's Steakhouse. And one day in the early fall of 1947, he walks in with Biggie into the restaurant, and he's sitting down. And Yogi had not dated all that much, had dated two girls previously and just was not somebody who was all that interested. And he looks across the room, and he sees Carmen Short, a beautiful young woman from Howes Mill, which is about 125 miles from St. Louis. And he begs the owner of the restaurant to introduce them. And when when one of the owners went over to Carmen and said, "I'd like to introduce a ball player," the only ball player she knew was Terry Moore, the name, and he looked nothing like Yogi, but he was also married. So Carmen was insulted that a married man would try to ask her out, and they assured Carmen that no. He's not married. He's a young ball player with the New York Yankees. And they started going out. And Carmen's sister, Bonnie, who's 4 years younger, lived together at this time in St. Louis, became a terrific source and a good friend, told me that it was not very long after that Carmen stopped seeing, in her words, the college hunks that she had been going out with, and just fell in love with Yogi. And they were engaged in July of 1948 and married in January of 1949 and stayed together for 65 years.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a baseball player doing that today. I'm sure there are many who do, but that seems like quite a remarkable long run there.
Well, I'll tell you a real quick story about that. There's an outfielder named Brett Butler who I met doing my first book, and he's running a program to counsel ball players towards the end of their career and to help them with their marriages. because he told me that 80% of baseball players get divorced when they retire.
Mm.
So, yes, it was a remarkable marriage.
So you also deal with Yogi's life as a father, and I got to admit, I mean, he does come across as just such an endearing person, but I cringed when I read the part where his son Dale asked him to play catch, and he said, "That's what you have brothers for." What kind of father was he overall?
Well, you know, Yogi played 19 years of baseball and then went right into managing and coaching, and he didn't take a uniform off until he was 65 years old.
Mm.
So for the entirety of his son's, three sons' lives, he was always away. He was either on the road or he was sleeping before getting up and going to the ballpark for the home games. So he really was, for the most part, an absentee father. By definition of his job. And actually, you know, I think the absence there was that he felt great that his kid started a business in 1992 to market Yogi's memorabilia and his image and handle all of his card shows. And he spent a lot of time with his adult son. So the time that he didn't have on the front part, he was able to enjoy on the back end.
Well, that's great. So he made up for some years that were maybe some benign neglect. And Carmen, obviously a great mother. It's not like these kids were being neglected in any clinical sense of the word. But yeah, an absentee father there for a while who made up for it. I did want to ask you about one other thing, though. At the beginning of the show, we talked about Yogi's father trying to talk him out of playing baseball. I thought it was fascinating that when his oldest son, Larry, was eligible for the professional baseball draft in 1968, Yogi and Carmen both said no. Why was that?
Well, Carmen told Larry that she thought that he would be the most likely of the three to go to and finish college.
Hmm.
And you have to remember the time. I mean, Larry is 2 years older than me, 3 years older than me, and I was the first in mom, 68. I was the first in my family to go to college. So going to college back then was something that now is, you know, for a good chunk of the country is taken for granted. But back then, it was something special. And Carmen and Yogi obviously didn't get to college, and Carmen wanted her sons to be educated.
Hmm.
And Larry, you know, the minute he was able to turn pro, which in those days, now it's at 18, but in those days it was 21 before you could accept a contract from a Major League Baseball team. And the day he turned 21, he applied for the draft.
Do you think there was some irony there that, you know, they wanted him to go to college? It was obviously a great intention, but he kind of ended up blocking his kid's professional baseball career for the best of intentions.
Yes, and to tell you the truth, I really think that was primarily Carmen, and that Yogi went along with what Carmen said. But Carmen was dead set. Carmen was a very sharp woman, and prized education. Did a lot of charity work in New Jersey to raise money for educational purposes, and she was just dead set on her son going to college.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and this book is such a good read. And John Pessa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, Sarah, it's been a pleasure. Anytime.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. That's 90.7 KWMU.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. Choosewood.com.